Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. I think it's well known that us humans are using a hell of a lot of land for food production, much more than is needed. On today's show, I spoke to ecologist and woodsman, best job title ever, Dave Barker, about regenerative farming and how we can once again work with the land and nature to create high standard, environmentally friendly and affordable food. From going into the details of how Dave's farm works to the real errors and issues of industrial farming, Dave strips it all back to clearly show how easy it can really be to rewild some areas and use the land more skillfully. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Dave, thanks so much for joining me on Into the Wild. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Not too bad today, thank you.
Good, good. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I've seen you on social media quite a lot, and I've been really looking forward to talking to you because it's a bit of a different topic today, and it's, although it's still very topical. Also, for the listeners, can I just say, we're doing this on Zoom for like the second time, so it's also a new experience for me because I can see you, Dave, as I'm talking to you, which is always a pleasure. For the listeners, can you just explain to me who you are and what is it you do?
Okay, so my name is Dave Barker. I'm a professional ecologist, also a professional woodsman, and also I'm a forest school leader. I'm mostly based in, down in South Devon.
Nice one. I was going to say this later on, but woodsman, can we just point out that's the coolest sounding job I think I've ever heard. What does that mean?
What's it mean? Okay, well, so being a woodsman, so most of my life, my working life has been involved working in the woods and a bit more holistic than being a forester who is mainly involved with producing and a crop of trees and then benefiting from that crop. A woodsman is a lot more holistic and looking at the overall woodland. You're almost like a sort of more of a sort of a an old steward, I would say, of the working sort of like with the woodland itself and sort of promoting the health and being of the woodland. A lot of modern day forestry is coming on a little bit more on board with that rather than being an extractive industry. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Do you want to hear what was in my head?
Okay, go on then.
I just had
Lord of the Rings treatment.
Yes. And I've never even seen Lord of the Rings. I've never even seen it, but I just had this picture of you with an axe walking around going, well, I'll use that when I need it.
Yeah. Well, I've got plenty of axes, plenty of chainsaws. So it's woodsman. It's literally my life is, you know, when I'm not indoors, I'm outdoors most of my working life. And even the ecology work is mainly based in woodland work. The ecology work I've mainly been doing the last 10 years is doing ecological sort of studies on bat species in relation to large infrastructure projects. So that mainly involves lots of catching bats and then fitting radio tags to them and then tracking them around and seeing where they go.
Oh, this job just gets cooler and cooler the more you talk about it.
Well, it keeps me out of trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a question we always ask our guests on Into the Wild, is for you, when did your loving for wildlife and nature and the outdoors, when did that start for you?
Okay, I think it started at a very, very early age. I think I was quite blessed with parents who loved the outdoors. Fond memory of my granddad particularly is that he was always on his allotment. So every time I went to sort of see my grandparents, he was always outdoors growing his own veg. I grew up in Berkshire, but in the Chiltern Hills. And we had a big, lovely woodland right on our back doorstep. And my mum and dad were very, very sort of like free giving in the fact that me and my brothers have spent most of our time running around the woods, making camps, terrorising the local farmer. That's always been my, being in the woodlands has always been my sort of happy place. Even to the sort of point when I used to get, I told I was going to the dentist, I used to run away to the woods and my brothers would dispatch to come and get me back.
I love that. Whereabouts in Berkshire did you say you grew up?
Just north of Reading, between Reading and Henley. So we're sort of like, it's a small little village. And if you look now at Google Maps, most of the woodlands sort of being surrounded by housing now and golf courses. But when I grew up in the 70s, it was all open farmland and very small community. And yeah, me and all the rest of the kids in the village used to just spend all our time just out and about, you know, terrorizing the village itself. If it was summer, it was always water fights, and if it was snowing, it was always snowball fights with everybody.
Yeah. So just endless. So,
yeah. So it's that's pretty much it. It's role models really as well. You know, it's very very nature based TV back then as well, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, it's just quite surprising comparing to what the kids watch nowadays. And you know, as I got older as well, sort of seeing the rise of people like Chris Packham on TV and stuff like this, even before that, having other sort of like TV personalities and TV shows that were very very nature focused.
Mm. It's funny you say that as well, because it's weird, even though it's disappeared, it's still what people clearly want. Anytime a nature show comes on TV, it gets a lot of attention, so it's clearly wanted.
No, yeah, you're completely right. You know, it's I find it really bizarre that I'm now doing forest school work, so I'm teaching kids how to play in the woods, which to me is really really strange. You know, it's a real flip around from the sort of the childhood I had.
Yeah,
and it's obviously that's a great reflection of where our society has gone over the sort of like the 40 years that I've been around plus.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And something I was reading about yourself is that you work quite a lot with positive relations with nature. Now, when you're working with that, what does that mean? What if we go into detail there?
Positive relationship with nature. So I think the key word there being relationship. I think like any relationship, whether it's a personal one you have with your partner or your family, it's a two-way street. And I think very much over the years that I've been around on this planet, the relationship has come very much one way. We are very extractive from nature as a culture. A big part of my work, what I try to sort of like weave in everything I do really, and especially the forest school work I do, is to sort of promote a culture of like one, gratitude of the natural world, and then a sort of a giving back and service towards nature.
Yeah.
And all that encompasses really. So that's the main positivity part of it. Trying to instill that love and care, and because if people don't love and care the natural world, they won't look after it. So that's my main driver there.
You focus a lot on farming in a lot of your work and the way we farm our food, essentially, yep. That then benefits nature. But starting at the beginning, I guess, where have we gone wrong in farming to not benefit nature?
Wow. Okay, bit of a big question.
Yeah, I thought that when I asked.
I suppose you could say where have we gone wrong with our relationship with nature is actually adopting farming full stop. Mm. So you could go back to the beginning of farming, and you know, and where has civilization and our culture and society has gone from that point onwards. But skipping forward to where we are now, I think over the many many years, sort of the contract as a living being on the planet with nature, we've sort of reneged on that quite a bit, and so for our relationship with the sort of natural world has completely broken down. And over the generations, we've lost this understanding of being sort of interconnected and interdependent with the natural world. And yeah, it's been this sort of sliding baseline of actually moving ourselves away from natural systems, you know, and also spiritually connected to the natural environment. A lot of that's been lost. And I think at this point in time where we are now, I think a lot of people are realizing this. And obviously with the COVID pandemic and, people going through lockdown and sort of being forcibly removed from the natural world, it's really impacted them hard. And we've been seeing like on social media, people are now craving it, and it's almost been like a wake-up call for lots of people.
Yeah, it's one of those things that when it's taken away, you realize how much you rely on it. And it was a very subconscious, very real, I don't want to sound too vegan hippie as I am, but it's a real innate thing inside you that when it is taken, you don't realize it's there day to day. And then when you take it away, it is a big shock. And do you think with the farming, do you think kind of, as we've gone on, a lot socially has changed, but we've not necessarily put those changes into farming. So we've just continued with similar methods and just, which is land space. Do you think that's one of the errors we've made?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, you don't have to go very, very far back to sort of, you know, when we were actually taking land out of production because we were producing more food. Mm. So this whole argument that, you know, you need industrial agriculture to feed the world is completely wrong. Mm. You know, if you actually look at the statistics, like 2/3 of the planet is actually fed by very, very small farms. It's been this shift towards industrializing farming that's probably in my experience has caused the problem. And, you know, I've been doing conservation and ecology work for 25 years, and about 10 years ago I moved away from that because I got more and more disheartened because actually it wasn't working, the conservation work.
Wow.
And, you know, in the UK, 70% of the land base is farming, and I've always been a real advocate of, like, it's all about the habitat, the quality of the habitat across the range. If we get that right, then nature looks after itself. So mm-hmm. But we've gone more and more down this industrial sort of view, industrial way of managing the land. So when I came across sort of agroecology and regenerative farming about 10 years ago, I completely jumped ship. So I thought to myself, well, you know, this, if we can fix farming, we can fix a lot of the problems that the natural world has. And also through food, which we all need, you know, if we get our food production right, that's actually more in harmony with nature. You know, a lot of the regenerative farming practices do heal rather than harm. That's one of the sort of our main phrases that we have here on our farm, is always asking the question, is it healing or is it harmful? And if it's harmful, you're doing it wrong. You know, it's a mindset change. This is the big thing we're looking for, is how you view and value your land base, and then working alongside it and within it, rather than being external from it and trying to push it and to mold it to what you want it to be. It's actually, you know, understanding and having some ecological knowledge and understanding of your land, and then working with that rather than fighting against it. And that's where it's all gone wrong. It's more of a sort of a cohabitation rather than a coexistence. That's the sort of like a vibe we got going on here.
Yeah, and I like that, because coexisting just makes it sound like, well, put up with it because we have to, whereas cohabiting is like, no, because it's good to. It's you can enjoy it, you can benefit from it as well. Yeah. I like that. I like that change of phrase.
Exactly. If you're coexistent, you're separate. You're like, I'm here, and the picture's over there, and that's where we went there, and we're here. And this is the one big problem. We're not accepting that we are connected fully to it and independent from it. And if you're cohabitating, you're living together, you know. It's like everything is important. And when I was working on Village Farm, we had this complete ban of certain words, and like pests. Nothing was a pest. Everything that happened on the land, it taught us and was telling us a story about what's happening, whether that animal was a domestic animal or was a wild animal. So it's like I'd like to say to people, if you are going to go into any sort of land management, don't do anything minimum for the first year. Just be on the land, watch it, record it, see what's happening there, learn the stories it's telling you, and then how you fit into that. And, you know, it's amazing when you do start working alongside it and with natural systems, how much more benefit it brings to your farming, and it brings to the quality of the actual food you're producing as well. Because there's so much research now, we've actually the actual quality of food we're producing, and actually how much nutrients it actually has compared to even like what our parents had.
Yeah,
it's completely dived, you know. And this then goes into your diet and goes into your own health and well-being. You know, if you heal the land, you're healing yourself. It's simple as that.
And what you just said there about watching the land for, you know, at least a seasonal year, I guess that really helps you kind of stop fighting against it. If you're trying to do one thing, but the land's going, that's not how we work here. Again, nature's going to benefit, but that's another incident there where you're going to benefit, like you said, to get the best out of the land that you're standing on.
Yeah, absolutely, hugely. Because, like, you know, it's observing the land, as you say, through all the seasons. So you're knowing where the sunlight is, you're knowing where the shelter is, you're knowing where the water's flowing on the land, you know, and the way we do our grazing is actually, you know, it's what we call holistic plan grazing, which is actually you are developing a plan that actually fits within the ecology of your land base you're working in. And actually, you're working with the number that animals the farm can carry. So you're not actually pushing it at all. You're working alongside with it. So we're working from the bottom up here. So we're all about soil recovery first, and you get that right. And then also working with the carrying capacity of the animals on the land. And as soon as the nature starts rebounding back, which is normally after the second year, you can then increase the capacity, say, like if you're doing grazing and animal agriculture, you can actually increase the capacity of animals that land can actually hold, because, you know, you're getting more diversity, you're getting more structure, you're getting more nutrient loads, so actually the animal numbers can actually go up. So this whole idea of regenerative farming can't produce as much food as industrial is load of bunkum as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, nature is the best teacher. Nature is the most efficient system on the planet. So if you're working alongside those and to those systems, you're going to have the best farming and the best food. It's simple.
It just makes sense. As you say it like that, it just makes sense.
Yeah.
This, we might have already briefly answered a bit of this question, but maybe we can go into a bit more detail. But how have the errors that we've made kind of through the years, last, well, X amount, let's say 50 odd years, affected nature and wildlife so far?
Well, I think I said it before, it's like we've bent nature to our will, really, and that's been the problem. We've pushed it and pushed it. It's like, I can't remember how many species there are. I think most of the farming is producing just over 5, you know, plant species, and that's feeding the whole planet, which is ridiculous. And as any biologist will tell you, if you start monocropping, that's when you get all the problems with pests and diseases coming in. And this is why then farmers have to go down the route of using pesticides and herbicides. And then literally you're in a spiral down. You know, you can't get out of that, you know. And we've got a farmer across the way from us who's an industrial dairy unit. And, you know, he hasn't got any soil on his farm anymore. He's just mining dirt. And he has to put all these inputs on it just to grow grass now.
What?
You know. Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. So, you know, we're in a very interesting teaching position, because we have, you know, we're doing this regenerative farming, and literally across the stream we have this industrial dairy unit, which is, it's literally very, very, you know, yin and yang. It's completely you know, opposite to what we're doing. And it's interesting, we've only been back on this land base for 3 summers now. And it's interesting to see that, you know, especially this year, his silage cutting is getting less and less. So he's literally on a race to the bottom. He's basically going to mine that farm until it's not productive anymore. Then he's probably going to sell up. Simple as that.
That's mad that grass isn't growing.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. You know, it's, and what do you expect? Because literally over there, it's not soil. It's just like, it's dirt. It's a growing medium where you have to put all the fertilizer in. And then because it's unhealthy, there's no life in it, then you then have to control all the diseases and pests that thrive in this bacteria-rich environment. So, yeah, it's a mad way. And I think, you know, looking at where the world's going anyway with the economy and climate change, we're going to have to move. Regenerative farming is going to happen anyway, because it's the only way that farming can happen without using all the chemical inputs and all the fossil fuels. When we're at Village Farm, as an example, we had 180 acres of land, and we at peak we had about 1,200 sheep on it. And the way we managed the farm, and the way we're doing the rotational migration around the farm with the animals, on farm diesel bill for 1 year was £150.
Wow,
it was so small. Yeah, well, we were running a few electric vehicles, but we had a small mini tractor. And, you know, because you're working to a natural system, and, you know, you're leapfrogging.
Yeah.
The way we're managing the way we're doing the mob grazing is literally the easy way to describe it is the actual animals go on a mini migration around the farm. So they don't come back to the same piece of land for 4 to 5 months. So you're mimicking a natural herd on the land. So you can imagine like the Serengeti, you know, you have all the wildebeest and all the zebras, and they'll be migrating, following the food and the flush of grass. So they'll be passing to and fro, probably twice a year.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to mimic here. So the land has 4 to 5 months of recovery. So in the summer, you know, we've got little rare breed sheep, Shetland Icelandics. And in the summer, the grass is way above their head. So people are so used to seeing sheep in like literally that much grass.
Yeah, tiny grass. You know?
Yeah. Our sheep go into one of their new paddocks in the summer and they just disappear. And all you see is the grass waving around. It's like having 80 velociraptors in the grass, you know. And then during the summer, you know, all animals will just eat the nutrient-rich tips of the grass, so they will eat those, and the rest of the grass is actually then trampled down, which then forms this lovely grass mat, which then decays down, and that's what's building your soil, and that's what's locking the atmosphere from the air atmosphere back into the soil. So, and there's a lot more science I can talk to about that. About regenerative farming, you know, that's another podcast, I think.
I'd be up for that. Let's do that. When we look at the UK, are there certain areas that have been affected the most with this kind of, with these errors?
No, it's systemic. It's everywhere. You know, you can look at most agricultural types, and specifically since the Second World War, as a throwback to lots of the industry to do with the war, they actually came up with fertilizers and, you know, pesticides. And if you look into it, it's quite horrific how a lot of the war machine got turned into agriculture after the Second World War. And from that point onwards, it's just spiraled down. And now we've arrived pretty much at the bottom. It's only been the last sort of 10 to 15 years that this regenerative agriculture has cottoned on. Places like the UK are the last places probably to sort of like adopt some of these methods, because we have what they call a non-brittle environment. So we're very humid, we have lots of high rainfall. So you can abuse the land here and things will still grow. But you have areas like the uplands. I'm not going to get into the debate about upland grazing, but most farming practices, because they've been industrialized, have had a massive effect on the environment. But you've also got to consider the markets and the economy of it, base of it all. And there's no true cost in food anymore. And it's one of the reasons we're not doing actual food production anymore, even though we make a small amount of income from having to do the annual shearing of the sheep. So to give a good example of this, we were asked to provide some forage food alongside some of the lamb we're producing for a top chef in London. And we sort of asked, what do you mean? He goes, well, can you supply some of the sort of the plants that the animals eat that we can eat? So forage food. So yeah, okay, we're looking into that. And we did that. So at the time, we were getting about £5.50 per kilo of the meat that we're selling. Rebecca, who I was working with, she did some online searchings, because we realised, okay, gorse flowers, people eat gorse flowers, sheep are eating the gorse. Let's pick a couple of kilos of gorse flowers. It took us a couple of hours.
Yeah.
So we did that. Then Rebecca went online to find out, you know, from a couple of professional foraging sites, how much you could earn, how much we need to charge for these forage flowers, yeah? So, you know, a long story short was, so here we are, we're sheep farming in a regenerative, environmentally way, high welfare, all this in mind. We've got a really good sort of top sort of like, sort of price for our meat. It's taken two years for an animal to grow to this state. You know, obviously the animal has died in the end and sacrificed its life to produce this food for people, and we're getting £5.50 a kilo. That's taken 2 years. We've gone out and we've picked some gorse flowers for 2 hours, and we can charge £60 a kilo.
What?
So exactly. So where's the true cost in that for an animal who? My time and effort for 2 years, and an animal's death to produce some really good food, some really nutrient dense food, and then comparing that to some picked flowers for a couple of hours. So that's a really good example of, you know, there is no true cost in food. If you talk to any dairy farmer, they're making losses. And this is why if you go online and search for land for sale, you see so many dairy farms up for sale now.
Yeah,
and I'm not an advocate for modern-day dairy anyway, but it just shows you there's this real concept that people want cheap food. And yeah, we do need cheap food, but one of the drivers we had at Village Farm is that we wanted to produce food that everybody could enjoy and everybody could afford. So we didn't put a high markup on what we were producing, because we wanted to produce high welfare, biodiversity sort of healing farming and produce from that. But and in the end, we were marketing on meat to customers at the same price or cheaper than Tesco Super Value stuff.
Wow.
And we were still making a profit on it.
Incredible.
And it's like I think the drive, the big changes I said before is as a farmer is the mindset change of getting out of the tractor. You see most farmers just sitting there, it's driving around their tractors, you know, it's like their Iron Man suit, put it that way. Once they get in that tractor, they can do anything, you know. Mm. It's like, you know, they can rip up the soil, they can spray things across it, they can transport the heaviest things ever. You know, I put a tweet out the other day. It's like, if you just limited the amount of power you can use on the farm, you would so much reduce actually, you know, what that farm can do. And you know, you would have to farm a lot more smarter. Mm. It's like, you know, you think how much horsepower a tractor has these days, and literally that is how many horses, you know, of power it can produce. You know, it's absolutely incredible. And the same is with fishing as well. You see these huge mega trawlers now that can string a huge net between them, and they're just hoovering up the ocean. I'm also a huge advocate. I'm not a vegetarian, I'm not a vegan, but I'm a massive advocate for more of a plant-based diet. It's better for the environment, it's better for people. And someone coined a phrase the other day at the Oxford Real Farmer Concert: if you are going to eat meat, make sure you source it from the best place possible, and it should almost just be a sprinkle on top of your food.
Yeah,
that is it. You know, we shouldn't be having meat every day. You know, when I grew up, you know, we had a roast chicken every Sunday, and that was a real like treat. You know, and people are having chicken every day now. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly how I view it. Because I'm vegan myself. I didn't like the taste of meat. I miss it occasionally, but I do it because I know enough people aren't reducing. And I'm like, well, I'll just take it out. Because like you said, my granddad and my dad said this to me, is that one chicken a week, you know, you looked forward to it and you made it last. And it's become such a normal three or four times a day people are eating meat.
Exactly. It's like, you know, there's like going along with the true cost of meat, it's like we just really got to cut down on our food waste as well. You waste so much food here. It's unbelievable. And also another thing, yet again, is like I'm banging on about, you know, regenerative farming, is like, even if you're just eating a plant-based diet, be very, very, very conscious of where you're getting that food from. You know, it's like this, it's one of the big worries I do have with all the new vegan food coming out. It's, a lot of it is packaged, and a lot of it is this fast food type of food coming out. And, you know, people just pick it up and it's boxed up. It says it's a plant-based burger. Let's have that, with no real thought about actually the ingredients of where that's coming from. You know, I was vegan for 3 years when I was a ranger back in Sussex. I put it down to the fact that being vegan really made me learn how to cook, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing we probably need in this country, is the revival of our cooking culture. Because if you start cooking raw ingredients, you start becoming aware where those ingredients have come from. And then that itself then feeds back to the farming, because the farmers will always follow the market. This is it. If there was a market in geese growing, sort of like geese, then most farmers are going to geese farming. You know, if it was like a, you know, avocado farming, let's go to avocado. If you can grow that sustainably and ethically in this country, which obviously we can't. But you know, if you, like, hopefully you get that. Yes, it's like the markets, the farmers will follow. And also, you know, I'm a real big advocate of bioregionalism and eating locally. So if you can. Source your food as locally as you can, and also make sure it's ethically as it can be. I'm very, very lucky here that we have our next door neighbours. They're a small horticultural operation. Mm. They have a very, very small piece of land, and you know, they're doing no-till veg growing, and it's not certified organic yet, but I think it's on its way, but it's pretty much organic food anyway. Yeah. So I know them very well, and they have limited inputs on it. And then you've got us next door to them doing our regenerative farming, livestock sort of production. Even though we're not selling meat, literally we're just using the sheep as an ecological functional land to repair it at the moment. I think between the two, you've got the right balance, and they're both small scale operations. And that's what we need replicated across the whole of the country. More farming in harmony with nature that embraces nature. Small scale veg growing and fruit growing, lots more orchards on the land.
Yeah.
And then this translates to a lot more people on the land. which is a hard thing to do with the land prices we have at the moment and the huge ownership issues we've got as well. So that's another topic to talk about in the podcast.
So you said then your farm wasn't, you're not selling the meat, but what are you selling anything on your farm at the moment?
At the moment, the sheep are just sort of covering their own initial costs through their wool sale. We've been very lucky that we got a few craft people who really love what we're doing on the land here and support us and give us a premium price for the wool, because we've got to shear the sheep once a year anyway, because for their own health and well-being. And who knows, with climate change coming, that might have to happen twice a year, sheep in a very, very warm climate don't really go very well. So they're covering their costs, because we've changed our farming location. We've scaled down quite a lot. We've gone down from 180 acres down to 45.
Oh, wow.
So we've got a very, very small operation. Yeah, and you at the moment, and you can't really make a massive income out of 45 acres. So therefore, we've had to diversify our income. So, hence I'm doing my bat survey work and my forest school work on top of actually, keeping the small scale farm here running, wilding it slowly over time, really, doing what we're doing.
And selling your flowers for £60 a kilo.
Yeah. That was 4 or 5 years ago now, so I don't know what the foraging market is. But there's still quite a lot of commercial foragers out there, but that's yet again another podcast on the ethics of doing that.
So the changes that we've been talking about of people, or especially if you look at the industry being heavily industrialised, how easy is that? I guess if we look at this from two ways, one of a physical change to make and to change the way we're farming, but also easy as in, do you think it will happen?
Well, I think it will happen. I think everything seems to be going the way of being electrified. At the moment, I haven't seen electric tractor that can produce enough power compared to a oil-based one.
Yeah.
Also, just with all the externalities, all the inputs that you have to put into industrial farming, the production of all the chemicals and all the fertilizers, all of that is fossil fuel based. So you take that away, all you have left to work with as a farmer is the ecology. The way we have to go is down the ecological route. Obviously, there's a big push on lab grown food now as well. And I think that probably, does have its place in certain areas. And it also is a lifeboat, I suppose, with climate change coming. What is the impact on farming going to be? And it's stupid not to have all the tools in your toolbox to help us keep feeding ourselves. But I think fundamentally, I'm a massive advocate of regenerative farming and ecological farming. I think it's such a win-win across the board for people and for the planet. It's huge, and we just need to advocate it and promote it as much as we can, because at the moment it gets zero funding, it gets zero research, because all that money is coming from the big industrial and the big chemical and the big oil companies. They're the ones pumping all the money into the industrial agriculture machine.
Yeah.
And that's where the advertising goes. Very much a lot of the ecological farming is self-promoted at the moment and is peer-reviewed by the practitioners doing it themselves, because if it didn't work, I wouldn't be doing it. Most farmers, if it doesn't work, they wouldn't be doing it. If it wasn't a win for them, they wouldn't be doing the practice of any of this regenerative work. And it works, just because there's been no huge amount of research done into it, doesn't mean anything really. Because most farmers, it's a hard life as it is. You're up against so much. And if something doesn't work, you will not be doing it. For anybody to say, well, this regenerative farming is a load of bunkum, we need industrial agriculture to feed the world, they're wrong, basically, in so many ways. It's a race. Industrial farming is, as I said before, it's a race to the bottom. It's the only way that's going is going to die, basically.
Yeah.
I just sort of see there's a growing cadre and cohorts of new regenerative farmers coming on board every year. In January, there's the Oxford Real Farming Conference, and it's probably one of the most hopeful conferences I've ever been to in my life. It's full of people have seen the light a little bit and know that actually industrial agriculture is obviously we're on a wrong pathway there.
Yeah,
the only path that leads to is more suffering and pain for both people and animals and wildlife and everything. It's full of young people as well, which is lovely, and everybody wants to get on the land and get on and do it. And it's now in the hands of, dare I say, politics. I'm going to leave it there because I'm not going to get into politics.
Yeah, that seems to be where it always stops.
It does. But the best thing about it with the Regen Ag world is people are on the ground doing it now.
Yeah.
You know, and if you want to support people, you can. So the main thing to do is to look online for farm shops. Look online for the farms themselves around you and buy direct from them. Most farms now have an online presence where you can buy direct from. Cool. It's asking people their story. You know, your food that you put in your mouth should have a story to it.
Mm.
You know, if you don't know the story of your food, then, you know, that's a worrying thing, because this is fundamentally, you know, your own health and well-being that you're putting in your mouth. The big corporations are very good at spinning stories. Go to most big supermarkets now and they've just created out of thin air names of farms. Yeah. And put those names on farms or packets and people think they're buying from a farm and they're not. Yeah.
My last question, and again, it's an Into the Wild question that everyone gets asked, and you might have already answered it, but let's see. If you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone on the planet, everyone would hear this bit of advice regarding the natural world, what would you pass on?
One thing would probably be just consume less. Mm. Less stuff. Stuff is never going to make you happy. Look for happiness outside your front door, being in nature. Another thing is sort of like try to actually change your mindset to actually sort of to have some sort of allegiance towards the natural world and sort of to have some sort of like give something back to nature, to the planet. Get outside and get your hands dirty. At the moment where we take too much, it's time to give back now.
Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on this show today and chat to you about some farming practices, and I've learned so much and I can't wait to share it with the world. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you and thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the work and projects that Dave is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at WoodlandDave. Don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello or share some thoughts on an episode or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Either way, until next time, keep well, stay safe and live the good life.